Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here and in downtown Chicago, the 18th floor, 303 Wacker. Here till 5 a.m. It's Monday, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about some of the most insane junk food ever. And some other food topics that we're going to get to as well. If you would like to join us at any time, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And you can also check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show, and Facebook, facebook.com/NickDShow as well. So it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Every week on Monday morning, Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me to review all the new movies, and then we discuss the box office as well. So we got a bunch of stuff to talk about, a bunch of movies to talk about here, and we're going to do that right now. So let's welcome the guys to the show. Here's Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So we got a bunch of stuff to talk about this week, and we'll get to the box office as well. Eric, why don't you start us off with a movie that neither Colin nor I have seen, and that's Gus Van Sant's new movie, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot.
Yeah, this is a film that I think I talked about when I saw it at Sundance earlier this year. As you mentioned, it's Gus Van Sant's latest film. It's based on a memoir by a cartoonist named John Callahan. It was a project that he actually was brought to Gus Van Sant's attention by Robin Williams some years ago. And there was some hope that he might actually play Callahan. Obviously, that didn't come to fruition. But Van Sant ended up making the movie afterwards and actually acknowledges Williams in the credits at one point. Instead, it's Joaquin Phoenix who plays Callahan. We sort of meet him. We sort of jump, flash forward and flash back through his life, mostly as an alcoholic. And at one point, he gets into a car with the wrong person, played by Jack Black, and ends up getting into a horrific car crash. And while Jack Black's character kind of walks away without a scratch, Callahan is left paralyzed and certainly sends him into even a greater alcoholic funk. Eventually, he starts to get some help, ends up going to kind of a new age guru camp headed by a guy played by Jonah Hill, and the movie kind of then eventually gets around to the part that you know of his life that he's most known for, which is his cartoons. Something that I was not fully aware when I saw the movie. I actually thought the way it was described, that he was a cartoonist before he got into the car crash. And that kind of, you know, watching the movie, you know, with that, you know, that kind of that foreknowledge, you know, the movie takes a long time to sort of get to the cartoon stuff. And as an outlet for his anger and his sense of humor and, you know, sort of his entire approach towards rehab, the movie doesn't really do a great job of sort of selling that point. I mean, the cartoons almost seem like an afterthought, something that we should have already been aware of, and that's not the least, or not the most interesting part of the story, when it probably is, because the rest of the movie, we sort of jokingly referred to the movie at Sundance as basically 12 steps the movie. You know, the movie at times is not that far distinguishable from something like 28 Days with Sandra Bullock. And ultimately, it's just kind of a slog to sit through. I think Jonah Hill gives the best performance in the movie, but it doesn't really give you anything new. It doesn't really tell you much about Callahan other than he was a drunk who did cartoons and was paralyzed. And so it doesn't really give you anything to grasp onto in any of those parts of his life. And, you know, doesn't really tell you anything new about any of those situations, even apart from Callahan's life. So, you know, kind of a big, you know, swing and a miss from Van Sant here.
Well, that's too bad. Because, I mean, Gus Van Sant, for the most part, I really like his stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is a really good cast.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, that's too bad. That's disappointing. Okay, that's Don't Worry, He Won't Get Too Far on Foot. He won't get far on foot. So that's the latest. And all right, Colin, why don't you tell us about The King?
All right. Well, this is a documentary about Elvis Presley, and you may be wondering, why do we need another documentary about Elvis? Aren't there already at least 50 or 100 out there that got the job done already? Well, yeah, but this one takes a look at the king in sort of modern-day context and uses his story, his life story, to tell the story of America. And, you know, the parallels and how we look at our idols and celebrities, how we've become corrupted in many ways, how damaged this country has become, and how, you know, we're now at the point in the Elvis story where he's about to go to the bathroom one last time, if we're using Elvis's life as a metaphor for America today. And if you think that's a bit of a stretch as an analogy, that's okay, because the director, Eugene Jarecki, he's our tour guide through all of this, and he's okay with having that conversation of whether or not this movie's point is even valid. And I say tour guide because this movie is a road trip, essentially through Elvis's history, through Mississippi, where he grew up, and, of course, Memphis and elsewhere in the South. And, of course, Vegas. And through all of this, Jarecki talks to musicians and actors, people like Chuck D, of course, because he has that famous lyric in Fight the Power about Elvis that I can't say here.
Yep.
Alec Baldwin, Ethan Hawke, John Hyatt, Emmylou Harris, James Carville, and M. Ward, and even Mike Myers, who you think, why is he in this? Well, he actually has some very valid points. He actually does justify being in this thing. And that's sort of an interesting, one of the interesting strengths about this movie is that, you know, I just read off a list of people who are, you know, kind of an odd assortment in a documentary about Elvis, but yet they're all there for a good reason. They all sort of justify their existence. Maybe not so much Alec Baldwin, but the others do. It's a really fascinating movie. I mean, it's a really cool, you know, road trip movie, as you know, you talked about earlier this week. And it is actually a sort of, you know, a refreshing sort of perspective on this life story that has been told time and time again. Whether you want to buy in, like I said, whether you want to buy into the metaphor is entirely up to you, and you can totally scoff at it and still kind of enjoy the movie because, you know, it's Elvis's life, and it's always been a fascinating one to look at. All the highs and lows and the tragedies and everything. They're all driving around in one of Elvis's old cars. So it's interesting. It's fun to watch some of the musicians get into this car and sit in the back seat and just suddenly go, whoa, I can't, you know, they sort of have this sort of spiritual moment or just a moment of recognition, like, wow, that's, I never thought I'd be here. So that's fun to watch too. So, I really recommend this movie. This is a really a terrific and thought provoking documentary that is an interesting, you know, a new perspective. And it's currently playing at the Music Box right now.
Okay.
So
yeah, I've seen the trailer for it. It looks like a really sort of unique and interesting take on the subject.
Yeah, I mean, and it better be, because really, if you're doing a documentary on Elvis, it better be different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
All right, well, there you go. The King, and that's playing at the Music Box. Mm-hmm. All right, Eric, why don't you tell us about Unfriended: Dark Web?
Okay, another film that I saw at a film festival back in March. This was at South by Southwest when it didn't have a title, and we were, when it was shown, we were, you know, surprised it's an Unfriended sequel, which, you know, we kind of already knew. But this one, again, takes the same gimmick that Unfriended did, that everything we're seeing is on a computer screen while various characters talk to each other through webcams and chat rooms and all that kind of stuff. Although this time, it's not so much the supernatural element. The guy at the beginning of the movie is trying to communicate with his deaf girlfriend, was using some new software. It doesn't quite turn out the way he had hoped. And part of the reason is that he is actually using a stolen laptop that he took from a local coffee shop, I think where he worked, and is participating using it on a game night with a number of his friends. Well, surprise, surprise, the laptop belongs to someone who is a regular participant on the dark web. And people not familiar with what the dark web is, let's just say you don't want to go there because that's where a lot of really ugly, horrible things, rumors and truth, you know, collide in this place. And it's just not a good place, you know, stuff film city, let's just say that. So the people, you know, who the secret society of the dark web want the laptop back, and if they're not going to get it, then they're going to basically hunt down all of his friends and make them pay for his transgression. All right. So you have that, and so you get exactly what you expect out of the first Unfriended movie with this one. The difference is that when the first Unfriended came along, I know Colin is a big fan of that movie, but he's not. No. But you and I were, Nick.
Yeah.
I think we both liked the movie.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first movies to use this type of filmmaking, to, you know, to put everything on a computer screen and watch people use their mouse and all this kind of stuff. And I felt it worked for the most part. A number of films since then haven't, including this one. And this one, you know, for a good portion of it, just feels like more of the same. Characters are not interesting in the slightest. Most of them are very dumb, including the lead character. And then it just gets uglier and uglier throughout. Horrible things happening to people that don't really deserve them, even if they are dumb. And again, this I've said this a couple times on the show now, I think, that the Blumhouse brand, this is a Blumhouse production, the Blumhouse productions have been using horrible real-life tragedies as props for their movies. And this was the first film where I noticed it, because there's an incident in the movie that involves swatting. And if you don't know what swatting is, people, I don't advise you to look it up, and you don't want to see it in this movie either. It's a really horrible real-life thing that happens where you call SWAT team on an unsuspecting person, and they end up getting killed because they think they're hostages or something horrible happening inside the house. That happens to one of the characters in this movie. And not only is it really dangerous, but it's also really stupidly done. So by the end of this movie, I was just like, I was done with this entire thing. I didn't want to see any more of it. And it's only disturbed me that that element of the Blumhouse horror film productions has only increased with both Truth or Dare and the first Purge. This isn't just an awful film and one of the worst films of the year.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but terrible things about it. So, all right, well, there you go. Unfriended, Dark Web, one of the worst movies of the year. Okay, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress, Colin Suter are here, and they join me every Monday morning to review movies. We're going to take a break when we come back with the news, and then after that, we'll jump back into all the new movie reviews, and then Eric will stick around, and we'll talk box office. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18th floor, 303 Wacker, downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on, because we like to start off your work week with a laugh. And we're going to be talking about junk food and much, much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. We are in the middle of the movie reviews. It's Monday morning, and then we review all the new movies on Monday. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me to talk that. Let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, I didn't get a chance to see this. I didn't get to see it over the weekend, but I understand it's really pretty great. So, Colin, tell us about Blindspotting.
All right. Well, this movie stars a couple guys you might not know. Well, David Diggs was one of the original Hamilton stars. He's also in Wonder, one of the teachers in Wonder, and Rafael Casal. These two also wrote the film, and they play a couple guys in Oakland who work for a moving company, and Diggs' character is on parole or probation and has 3 more days of living a crime-free life before he is completely free. And it's not easy in a place like Oakland, you know, when his friends are still steeped in guns and drugs and he has to try and keep from being at the wrong place at the wrong time. And it's important to note that Diggs' character is black and Cassell is white because race plays a big part in what this film is about. And Cassell's character is a guy who thinks he's as black as everyone else. And of course, that causes a lot of conflict, a lot of it which is unnecessary when they run into people. And so this movie takes place in Oakland, California, much like Sorry to Bother You, which, in this film, the city of Oakland is rapidly going through a gentrification, which adds to the tension. Of course, all cities in America are going through this, but that's one of the central themes of the movie is this gentrification. As one of the many themes this movie covers, this is a multifaceted piece that is also very funny, but is also has a lot on its mind with regards to race and this feeling of, you know, your neighborhood changing before your eyes, and not just changing, but completely like being wiped away, you know, without any real care or regard for, you know, the people in the neighborhood. It's also a very suspenseful film because every time, you know, Diggs' character is in a potentially bad situation, you're just kind of on the edge of your seat, like, oh, please don't let a cop car come around him and find him there, you know, because that's it for him. And, you know, we really root for him to stay on the straight and narrow. And we've all seen a movie, you know, or a TV show where somebody is in this situation and doesn't make it. And so, I mean, this is a really... this is a movie that kind of takes more than just a little quick review and summary to really sum up everything that it has to say. Just suffice to say that the two leads here are really incredible, and they took about 10 years to get this movie off the ground, and these guys have known each other since high school, and you can really tell the camaraderie here is real. It's not, you know, a couple actors who got cast in this thing. Like, this is a very personal project for them. And it was originally supposed to be all done in verse, kind of like Spike Lee did with Chirac, but only parts of it are. And when it is, it's really extraordinary. So, this is absolutely one of the best films of the year. It's one of the best social commentary films of the last few years. It's one of the best comedies, and it certainly fits in there with a lot of other films about race in America lately that has a lot to say. So, absolutely, this is definitely one of the best films of the year.
Okay. All right. Eric?
Yeah, I like the film, too. I saw it at Sundance this year, and not saying that other people have to choose between them, but I'll absolutely take this over Sorry to Bother You every day of the week. I mean, this movie, you know, kind of, you know, bursts forth with a lot of a really strong comic energy that you don't see a lot of films, you know, really, you know, get out of the box with. And, I think that some of the elements, throughout the film, you know, some of the more suspenseful elements, some of that stuff works. Some of it, again, feels like the sort of the necessity of the kind of story it's trying to tell, situations that we've, again, have been in before. I think the climax of the movie, although, ends, you know, with a pretty spectacular moment of verse, does feel a little too on the nose for my taste, but doesn't completely diminish the film at all. This is a strong film, and David Diggs, you know, people who had got to see the original production of Hamilton and have only seen him like little fits and spurts, Wonder, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, he's been on, are really gonna see what could amount to a real sort of breakthrough moment for him in film. Now, this is definitely a film to check out.
Okay, all right, there you go. So that's Blind Spotting. And it's out right now and highly recommended by both Colin and Eric. Okay. Eric, tell us about Eighth Grade.
Okay. Well, we got a theme going here. This also premiered at Sundance and was the closing night film of our Chicago Critics Film Festival. Sold out closing night, as a matter of fact. This is the writing directing debut of comedian Bo Burnham. The topic of Eighth Grade doesn't seem like the the kind of topic that a comedian of his ilk would tackle. But this movie told from the perspective of a 13-year-old girl, played by Elsie Fisher, who is, you know, in that true middle state. You know, it's middle school, it's, you know, it's kind of middle age for children, where they're not quite an adult yet, but certainly not a kid anymore. And, you know, she also doesn't really have a lot of friends. You know, she's not, you know, unpopular, but she's certainly not, you know, popular by any stretch. Her dad, played by Josh Hamilton, is doing his best to try to be as present as possible, sometimes a little overly present, and it kind of leads to that, again, that embarrassing stretch that the teenagers, the verging of teenagers, often go through. But she's doing her best to basically survive the final weeks of eighth grade before she goes off to high school. You know, what is that world going to be like? And, you know, is she going to need friends, you know, to enter this place before she gets there? And, you know, so there are a lot of scenes, you know, moments in the movie involving her, you know, going to a pool party, trying to make some friends, and, you know, trying to hang out with some of the more popular kids, you know, even if they don't really want her there. And also, you know, trying to, you know, strike up, you know, possibly a new relationship with some boys in her class. And that leads to a number of really kind of awkward moments, not just for her, but for the audience as well. I mean, this is a really, you know, kind of nuanced take of this period. I mean, there are movies, we've seen a lot of movies over the last couple of years about, you know, Saoirse Ronan, Lady Bird, On Her Way to College, Edge of 17, another, you know, sort of really awkward point. And this movie, you know, sort of feels like the prequel to those. I mean, that actually makes for a really kind of fantastic trilogy to show to young women about the various stages of their life. And, you know, I'm trying to remember a movie that really captured this particular period of you know, of anyone's life, boy or girl. I think there's so much to relate to in this film, even though it is told from a girl's perspective. I think anyone, you know, we were all 13 at some point, and I think you know, even some popular kids will probably recognize moments like this of that extreme awkwardness and not knowing how to act around people and exactly, you know, where the next day is going to take them. And it's a really kind of wonderful film in that way. And you know, I know it's R-rated for a little bit of salty language and a couple of really awkward moments involving you know, sexual situations in the film, but this is the kind of film that parents should be encouraged to take their kids to, because I think this, you know, could, you know, serve as a real, not just a learning tool, but kind of a real sense of comfort for them that they are not alone in this world, which this film, you know, basically is trying to show. So this is definitely one people need to see.
Okay. Colin?
Yeah, again, one of the best films of the year. You know, this is a pretty great weekend for these movies. You know what? Eric is definitely right. This is a movie that you don't have to be a young person or even a, you know, young woman to enjoy. In fact, Bo Burnham has said that, you know, he didn't make this movie to show like what adolescence was like for him or how he reacted. He said, this is my life right now. So, you know, that's very true. You know, you can be an adult and watch this thing and be like, yeah, this is actually kind of what I'm going through right now, actually, a little bit. And it's not just a great, like, thoughtful, insightful movie, you know, coming of age movie. We've seen those, and we've seen, you know, we kind of have an idea in our head of what an indie film coming of age movie looks like. But this movie, Bo Burnham goes out of his way to kind of make it a different kind of cinematic experience as well. You know, visually, he's already coming on a very, as a very strong filmmaker. And you know, the score he uses is very weird and very sort of cacophonous and just a little, you know, definitely different from what you've heard in other movies like this. You know, there are sequences that are kind of non sequiturs. Especially one towards the end that I have no idea where it came from, but it's there and it's kind of hard to imagine the movie without it now. But, and also he's just got a really charming lead in the whole thing. It's kind of taking you through this. This Elsie Fisher is fantastic. And I think she's only done like one of the voices in Despicable Me before this. So this is what you call a breakout role. She definitely brings a lot of her own, you know, personality and charm to the role, and is just fascinating to watch. And it's also cool that the adults in the story aren't portrayed as blithering idiots or overly intrusive or whatever. Like, there's really strong adult relationships in this thing too. This is all around a great film, one that I can't wait to see again. I haven't seen it since our festival, but I definitely can't wait to see it again.
Okay, we'll take a break, and I'll tell you you guys what I thought of it as well. This is the movie Eighth Grade, and Eric, hang on. Colin, hang on. We'll take a break. When we come back, I'll let you know what I thought of Eighth Grade. We got a couple more movies to review after that, right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here. And right now we are doing our Monday morning movie reviews, and then Eric's going to stick around and we'll talk box office as well. So Eric Childress, Colin Suter here. They join me every week. Before the break, Eric and Colin reviewed Eighth Grade. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So Eighth Grade, this is a really special movie. A really, really, really special movie. I think I agree with you guys entirely. I think it's one of the best movies of the year. What Bo Burnham has done is really pretty remarkable. Because, you know, what you said, Colin, where he talks about how this is his life now. Everybody can identify with this movie. And I haven't been in eighth grade for 40 years. But this is pretty much what it was like. So, I mean, I'm just saying. I mean, it's been 40 years since I've been in eighth grade, but this movie captures that time period really well. And I really don't want people to be put off by the R rating, and I'm glad you brought this up because kids need to see this movie. This is a movie that I think that you're 13, 14, 15 years old, you're going to love this movie. It captures that awkwardness, and you're right, Colin, it's very uniquely directed. I the only thing I know about Bo Burnham is that I've seen his stand up and I've seen him guest on talk shows, but this guy's a natural born filmmaker, man. And he's a great storyteller, and he wrote this, he directed it, and everything about it is good. And you're right. You guys are right. I mean, the adult characters do not come off terribly, like a lot of these movies, the lesser movies, because you guys mentioned, Lady Bird and Edge of 17. Those are two of my favorite movies of the past few years. And this one ranks right up there with those two films as well. And this lead, man, this Elsie Fisher is great. This is, like you said, Colin, this is a breakout performance. This is a star-making performance, I think. And she kind of came from nowhere and owns this movie, and it's real, it's awkward, it's funny, and I just loved everything about it. I think it's one of the best movies of the year, and she gives one of the best performances of the year, and Bo Burnham knocks one out right out, first time out, and knocks it out of the park. This is one of the best movies of the year, and that's Eighth Grade. It's playing in three theaters. It's at the River East, it's at the Landmark Century, and in Evanston. Eric, are they going to plan on maybe opening this a little bit wider?
Yeah, oh yeah, most definitely. It expanded this week. They had that huge per screen average last week,
yeah.
The biggest of the year, in fact. And it expanded to 33 theaters this weekend, including in Chicago. And I think throughout August you're going to see this expanded even more.
Yeah,
right,
no,
in time for school too.
No, I agree with you. I think this is going to be a breakout. I'm glad that they're actually going to release it. And Bo Burnham has been making the rounds on the talk shows, and all of the people that have interviewed him have just waxed beautifully about this movie. And so I think it's getting the release at the right time, and I think it's getting the buzz going at the right time. And I got a feeling that this thing is going to really find a very, very passionate audience. And I hope it does. It's a very special movie. So Eighth Grade. And again, remember the name Elsie Fisher. Just remember it. Because she's going to be around for a while. That's my prediction. So anyway, one of the best movies of the year, Eighth Grade. All right. Well, Eric.
Yeah.
I didn't see it because I didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the first Mamma Mia, but there was mm-hmm. no way I was going to sit through another Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
So, Eric, tell us about Mamma Mia. Here we go again.
Okay. Well, this is a sequel / prequel to the 2008 adaptation of the stage, quote-unquote, jukebox musical known as Mamma Mia. In this story, Amanda Seyfried, who was the daughter of Meryl Streep, I've seen conflicting, I can't remember if it was 5 or 10 years after the events of the original film. I've seen conflicting reports on both of those, but it doesn't matter. It's several years past the first film, and Meryl Streep's character is no longer with us. And her daughter is trying to honor her memory by getting the hotel going where all the action took place in the first film. And while she's doing that, we get treated, or so to speak, back to flashbacks of Meryl Streep's character before she got pregnant, how she met her three suitors, who would eventually be played by Colin Firth, Pierce Brosnan, and Stellan Skarsgård. And the young Meryl Streep is played by the really lovely Lily James. And, she's went abroad and ends up having relations with all three of these guys, different, in a very short period of time. And she sings ABBA songs with her two friends that we know from the first movie, and sings more ABBA songs with the guys that she sleeps with. And we keep going back and forth to the present and back, and there's little twists and turns here and there that happen late in the movie that would actually might have given the film a greater bit of context. But the movie, kind of fails on that one bit as well. Confession time for me in that I don't mind ABBA. ABBA was played a lot in my house growing up, so whether I became used to it, numb to it, or accepted some of their grand ballads and melodies, whatever you want to say, so I don't mind the fact that these musicals are based on ABBA. I do have a problem, though, with the fact that I don't care about anything that's happening in these movies. The first film, this grand mystery about who is the mysterious suitor, who is Amanda Seyfried's father, and they used ABBA songs to, relay that fact. It just, like, who cared? Who cared? And in this movie, it seems it's even more so, because the flashback structure doesn't really help you with any of that. I mean, it just seems like a more excuse to find kind of an impressive nature of the deep cuts that they go through with ABBA. I assume they're deep cuts because they're not all of the big hits that we expect out of this thing, although they do reprise a few of the ones that we heard in the original film, including Dancing Queen and some others. But by the time you sort of get to like the final act of this movie, and Amanda Seyfried's character is having these revelations about, like, well, now I know what my mother went through, and I feel just like she did. Like none of that resonates in the slightest. And there could have been something really interesting, given the context of the times that we're living in, and how a single mother would go through a situation like this in her life. But apparently all you have to do in this movie is sing a few ABBA songs and you eventually get through it. As far as giving in to the joyous delight of these movies, I call hogwash on that, because even if you're enjoying the ABBA songs, I can go to a karaoke bar and see not just better renditions of ABBA songs, but if I just want to see other people having a good time, I could do that. Because none of these movies generate anything but for like the hardest core Mamma Mia fans. I mean, the musical numbers are not particularly well staged. They're incredibly stiff. They're the big dancing queen moment in the film that involves boats and piers and all kinds of people. Looks like the worst flash mob ever assembled. There's people just kind of showing up and, you know, trying to do the moves that other people are doing. It's all very stiff and ridiculous. So the idea that we're just supposed to throw up our hands and you know, give in to this thing now, which it seems like a lot of people seem to be doing, I call nonsense on that, because there's nothing in this movie worth caring about. Like I said, you can go to a karaoke lounge and see people sing Mamma Mia with all the fervor that the participants do in this movie. It's not good.
All right. Colin, Eric, hang on, okay, guys?
Mm-hmm.
All right. They're going to hang on. When we come back, we'll find out what Colin thought of Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. I didn't see it, and I'm happy about that. So we'll take a break, and we'll come back with more Monday morning movie reviews right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here, 18th floor, 303 Wacker. We're here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And we're going to talk about insane junk food and lots of other fun stuff. Phone number 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/NickDShow and at NickDShow for Twitter. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, they join me every Monday morning for the movie reviews. Eric will stick around and we'll talk box office as well. Before the break, Eric told us about Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, so Colin, you tell us what you thought of this Mamma Mia thing.
Yeah, so I agree with much of what Eric said, but I will confess also, I don't really hate ABBA either. You know, don't love it, don't have it in my music collection, but, you know, I can think of worse things to listen to. I really can. This was certainly not a necessary sequel because the story doesn't go anywhere new. It's basically Amanda Seyfried's character opening a hotel and hoping everybody shows up, and then they do, and then that's kind of the end of that story. You know, nothing else really matters beyond that. And that happens about halfway through the film. So, you know, without the musical numbers, this movie would barely fill 60 minutes. You know, the musical numbers that are there, when they're not sung by the men, they're not that bad to listen to. Because the men in this movie cannot sing. And that obviously includes Pierce Brosnan. You know, I remember when that first one came out, people were pretty vocal about how terrible he was in that as a singer. And, you know, in this movie, they kind of had amnesia about that, and they actually give him, like, a little quiet ballad to sing by himself, which is a big miscalculation there. And, you know, this is one of those movies where, you know, it is pretty much a jukebox musical, because there's not a single scene that can end without an ABBA song being put in. It's just like wall-to-wall ABBA songs. And there's not a lot of easy transitions into the musical numbers either. It's not a very organic flow from dialogue scene right into a song. And the director, Ole Parker is his name, really needs to kind of learn the craft of making these songs, you know, a part of the framework in a way that makes sense. Because right now they're just like, well, what do? Well, let's sing an ABBA song. You need more than that for a musical to work. As far as, like, you know, the big numbers with the big dance numbers, I thought they were okay. I mean, there are some times when I was able to kind of give in to this sort of happiness about it. I can't exactly, you know, truly hate a movie that is just happy and wears that happiness on its sleeve. And, you know, I think you can go a long way with, you know, good editing and just the right attitude, which at times this movie does have. You know, this is definitely a movie made for very specific demographics. It's not me, but that doesn't mean that there weren't little moments that I did enjoy. But on the whole, no, I don't recommend this movie either, and I'm sure hopefully we'll get a better musical before the year is out, since musicals are kind of back in vogue now. I don't know what it's going to be. I don't have the release dates or anything in front of me to show me if there's any musicals coming out. But there's probably at least one good one, hopefully, coming out before the end of the year. Something better than this, hopefully. So, yeah. If you're a big fan of the first one, you're probably already going to see this movie anyway, regardless. So, but I was not a fan.
Okay. All right. Well, Colin, why don't you tell us about The Equalizer 2?
All right. Well, this is another sequel I didn't really want. but I got anyway, but I'll take, you know, this is a better idea for a sequel than Mamma Mia 2. And it's Denzel Washington playing an Uber driver, or is it Lyft? I'm not sure.
It's Lyft.
Okay. And he's got a fist of iron and a heart of gold, and he lives in a modest apartment where he befriends a teenager, played by Ashton Sanders, and tries to keep him on the straight and narrow, away from the thug life. And he's also friends with an elderly man played by Orson Bean.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, Orson Bean, I was so, it was, for me, it was just lovely to see him. That's all I'm saying. I love Orson Bean. I love that man.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a highlight. And, you know, he's one of Denzel Washington's regular Lyft customers, and he doesn't tip very well. But anyway, but the action plot here, because this is an action movie, deals with one of the Equalizer's old friends from the CIA, played by Melissa Leo, who goes to investigate this murder-suicide of a high-ranking official, government official in Europe, I believe.
Brussels,
right. And when something happens to her during this investigation, he takes it upon himself to find those responsible and get revenge. And so this is a movie that, I don't know, like I said, I didn't really need a sequel to this, but okay, it's Denzel Washington, fine. And, you know, the sort of like standalone moments of him finding, you know, people who are doing bad things and dealing with them is kind of fun to watch. And actually, this is kind of like, for a while anyway, this is sort of a more quieter, more character-driven thriller when it deals with the teenager and with the Orson Bean character. And so I thought, like, the aspects of that were actually kind of interesting. It seemed like, for a while in this movie, Antoine Fuqua, who, you know, directed the first one, seemed to be more interested in making a character-based movie with Denzel than the movie that they were making. But then once it settles into the movie that they're making, then it just gets, you know, sort of very routine until, like, the last half hour, where it just gets completely ridiculous and it starts to become Hurricane Heist again. It just seemed like they threw this pointless element into the final action scene that just didn't need to be there, except just to have a lot of green screen action, I guess. We don't need that. It's Denzel Washington as the equalizer. Sorry. You know, just let him do what he does. And it just kind of, like, I didn't really care anyway about that side of the story. And then the way everything ties up at the end just kind of, you know, just kind of rolled my eyes going, this is really what it's building up to. Good God. So, you know, in spite of some really fun moments, and, you know, obviously Denzel Washington, one of the most watchable actors out there, even when he's in something not very good, it's still a movie I just could not care less about, and I kind of forgot about it as soon as I walked out of the theater.
Okay. All right, well, hang on. We'll find out what Eric thought of The Equalizer 2, and then what I thought of The Equalizer 2 as well, after we take this break here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we also have the Monday morning movie reviews, which we're doing right now. And we'll also talk about the box office as well. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every week. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Colin.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Eric, what did you think of The Equalizer 2?
I really did not like this movie at all. As Colin mentioned, you know, this movie for a while, you know, becomes a sort of this quieter, you know, more introspective, film that, you know, really kind of takes up the better part of the first hour of this movie. And every time, you know, it settles into, you know, whether dealing with Orson Bean or Ashton Sanders, I kept waiting to hear a voice on the soundtrack going, this week on The Equalizer. You know, it just seems like, is this what we came to see here? I mean, I know he kind of helps out a few people on the side in the first movie, but there was, you know, kind of a plot to sort of get us through the entire movie, and that, all the stuff with Ashton Sanders, you know, painting over the graffiti on the wall, and the, you know, just, you know, throwing the Orson Bean character in and out of the plot line, really, you know, it calls to attention just how disconnected those first two big action scenes are at the beginning of the movie, which have nothing to do with the rest of the movie. One involving a kidnapped kid, and the other involving basically a sexual assault that results in probably the first time I've seen a credit card used as a weapon since Burt Reynolds in Heat several years ago. And also, and there's also a real viciousness, particularly to that sexual assault scene. There's a thing that happens with a hand in that movie that actually made me wince in the theater. But then the movie kind of quiets down, and it works in the this revenge plot very casually. Even so that there's a the character in the movie that the first time we see this one particular character, you're like, well, that's the bad guy right there. So it's like, it's not even, that great of a mystery. And by the time it gets to, the two sort of later set pieces of the movie, one involving a hiding out in Denzel Washington's apartment, which is handled so awkwardly as to give, one character, a couple of phobias introduced at that very moment, and then they don't even do anything with the phobia. So they don't even set it up well, and then they hardly even pay it off. And then, like Colin mentioned, whoever decided, looked at the first movie and go like, okay, we climaxed the first movie in basically a giant Home Depot warehouse where Denzel could MacGyver his way through any weapon he possibly wants. How could we make that bigger? And someone went, hurricane. And my heart just kind of, I was not enjoying the film up to that point, but I'm just like, I waited this entire movie to see a guy try to snipe Denzel Washington in a hurricane. I just felt like such a waste of my time. Like, I came there to see Denzel Washington equalize, and by the end I felt on the negative end of that spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't hate it. I think I'm more with Colin on this one. I think there are some great moments in it. I think Denzel is great because he's Denzel, and to watch him beat the crap out of people makes me happy. You get a little bit of Melissa Leo, but her, the scene with her and those two guys is brutal. I mean, I was really like, my God.
Hoagland got something about beating up Melissa Leo.
Yeah, I don't know.
He did that in Olympus Has Fallen, too.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It was a little bit hard to watch. But, Denzel is never not watchable. I didn't hate the stuff between him and Ashton Sanders. I actually enjoyed the scene where he, tries to take him out of the room with all the drug dealers and stuff, and then they have a little confrontation in the hallway. I actually thought that was, well done, and I thought pretty intensely acted by Denzel. I didn't think it was gonna go to that level, but it did. I love the scene at the beginning. I know the scene at the beginning on the train has nothing to do with anything really, but it's I still got I still actually enjoyed watching Denzel smacking people around and all that cool stuff. So I didn't hate this, but I will say this: you're right about like last week in Skyscraper, when we reviewed Skyscraper, not real hard to figure out who the bad guys were in that movie and who was gonna make a turn. Because it's interesting to see, that it's completely obvious as to who the bad guys are and who's gonna turn, and it's completely obvious in this movie as well, what happens. But yeah, that last 20 minutes, that last 20 minutes in this movie is just really not well done, and with the hurricane and everything, it just goes on forever too. And there's nothing really, there's nothing really fresh about it. And all of the other sort of action sequences in the movie that lead up to the climax, I think, are well done. There's an incident that happens in his lift. He gets attacked while he's driving his car. I thought that was really well done. I thought all the fight scenes where he beats the crap out of the where he beats the hell out of the guys, the douchebag guys, I thought that was really cool. All of that stuff was really a lot of fun. It's just that the last 20 minutes for me was just, it felt forever, and it took forever to end. And how it did end was exactly how, we all knew it was going to end. You know what I mean? It's not like we didn't know what was going to happen and who was going to come out on top, and in fact, how it was going to happen. Because there's a part in the movie in the last 20 minutes of the movie during the hurricane and the guys trying to kill Denzel, where they as soon as you see like a tower in the middle of this town, you go, oh, okay, I know what's going to happen now. I know exactly how this is going to end. And it does. And getting there was what it took forever. So I'm recommending this actually because I think it's pretty good. And I mean, it is the last 20 minutes is it feels like it's never going to end. But I think leading up to that, there's enough good stuff. I think Denzel's really, really great in it. And it's a treat to see Orson Bean. That's all I'm saying. I love Orson Bean. Yeah, I got very excited. I saw the movie with my folks, and as soon as he came on screen, I went, Orson Bean! And my parents were like, wow, I didn't even recognize him. So, but anyway, I didn't hate it. It, Denzel is Denzel, and he beats people up, and that's what I wanted. So, there you go. All right, now, you guys are going to be off next week, correct? Eric, you're going to be...
Yep.
You're going to be in you're going to be in Vegas and mm-hmm. And Colin, you're going to be on the road.
Yep, pretty much.
Okay, and then I guess Jim's going to sit in with us. Jim Leskowski is going to sit in with us. We only got a couple of movies to review next week, but a really big one: Mission Impossible, Fallout.
Uh-huh.
Which,
oh yeah,
man, looks so good. And
can't wait.
And the buzz is really, really good on it too. From what
Huge.
I hear, for the first, I read one quote that said it's the best action movie since Fury Road, and I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's the longest of all the Mission Impossible movies.
Yep.
Clocking in at 2.5 hours, man. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I hear the climax is like a half hour long.
I'm very excited. I'm very excited. I'm going to see it in the IMAX. I want it loud. I want it big. And it's going to be great. So, all right. Well, you guys are going to be off. But, Eric, you may call in, right, from Vegas?
Possibly.
Yeah,
see how I'm feeling.
I was going to say, unless you're down, and
right.
then, that might not work. All right, well, listen, Colin, have a great trip, man.
Thank you.
Have fun, and Now, where else are you guys going? You're going to New Orleans, right?
We're going to Corpus Christi. We're going to New Orleans. We're going to take a stop in Alabama for a museum thing, and then Atlanta, Georgia, then Memphis, then back home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's going all over the South.
Wow, that's great, man. Well, have fun, and let me tell you something. Every meal that you eat in New Orleans will be good. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because the food,
what everyone says.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right, well, have fun, Colin. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
There you go. That's Colin. Eric, hang on. We're going to take a – are we taking a break? No, we're not breaking. Oh, let's not break. All right, Eric. Let's talk box office.
Okay.
Surprised, right?
Oh, yeah.
Equalizer 2 ends up being number one at the box office with $35.8 million. That's good money, man.
Yeah, I literally had to rewrite a good portion of my article this weekend because, I predicted last week Mamma Mia was going to be on top.
Yeah.
And as the Thursday and the Friday numbers came in, Mamma Mia was well ahead, in estimates on over the Equalizer. And, both were performing better than people thought they were going to. But Mamma Mia was they're estimating over $40 million.
Yeah.
And they had Equalizer in the low to mid-30s, like 33, 34, which was still much better than they were projecting. And just sometime between Saturday and Sunday, they swapped. And Mamma Mia fell back, and Equalizer took the top spot.
Well, it was pretty well attended on Saturday afternoon when we went.
Yeah, biggest opening of Fuqua's career, third biggest of Denzel's.
Wow. Okay, so that's $35.8 million. Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again came in second with $34.3
million.
Those are bigger numbers than the original one, right?
Bigger numbers than the original. First one opened at $27.7 million, the first movie actually stayed in the top 10 for 10 straight weeks.
Jeez.
Which is, you don't hear that a lot. Whether this one will is left to be seen.
Okay. And then now coming in at number three is Hotel Transylvania 3 with $23.1 million. It's up to $91 million total. Is that keeping up with the other ones?
Yeah, pretty much doing exactly what's expected to do. It should very easily turn a profit with the international returns as well. So it's doing just fine.
Okay. Number four is Ant-Man and the Wasp with $16 million, and that's up to $164.6 million. Is that comparable to what the first one did?
Yeah, it looks like it's going to pass the original's gross. It's heading its way towards $200 million, which the first one did not hit. So there's a very good chance that it's going to.
Okay. Now number five is Incredibles 2 with $11.1 million, bringing its total just in America to $557 million.
Yeah, absolute monster. Wow. That's one of the biggest grossing films of all time.
Six, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, $11 million, $383.9 million. doing well, but not nearly as well as the original Jurassic World.
Yeah, I mean, like, comparing it to Jurassic World, not great. Comparing it to Universal's entire, war, if you will, it's like the second big. It's going to be the second biggest grossing film in Universal's history.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking a difference between like $600 million for the Jurassic World, and then it's probably $400 some million for Fallen Kingdom. So.
Mm-hmm.
Not too shabby.
Number seven, Skyscraper, $10.9 million, $46.7 million in America, but the China numbers came out.
Did they come out officially?
$67 million.
It did. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't see those numbers.
Yeah. So, and you predicted that last week because mm-hmm. because you said, hey, the movie takes place in Hong Kong. Wait till the China numbers come out, and there you
That's
go.
That's right.
Then the first Purge with $4.9 million. Unfriended, Dark Web, only $3.4 million, which is encouraging.
Yes, it is, actually.
And then Sorry to Bother You with $2.8 million.
Kind of dropped off. Not exactly the hit, the huge numbers that people were kind of expecting out of it. I didn't really put a lot of stock into that. I think soon you're going to see, once A24 gets 8th grade in there, you're going to see that creep into the top 10 eventually sometime next month.
I hope so, because it's so good. All right, so we're off next week. Mission Impossible, Fallout opens, and very excited about that. But actually, I'm off the following week, so we're going to be off for a couple of weeks.
You got Flashback that weekend.
Flashback convention the following weekend, and then I always take some days off after that. So, all right, Eric, have fun, buddy.
Thanks a lot.
See you later. There's Eric Childress, everybody, and that's the box office. All right, we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN.